Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Well, Ronnie, it's a brand new year, 2012, and we hope all of you out there had a great, happy holiday, and we wish you a happy and healthy year.
I don't have any...
Wait, how'd you spend your holidays?
Very quiet. Santa brought me some presents, and fell asleep around 10 o'clock on New Year's Eve. Anticipating what we hope is going to be a great year before the Mayan calendar takes over on December 21.
The end of the world again this year.
Although the world may end earlier if Tebow loses Saturday to New England.
Well, I think we wish...
God may just say, may pack it up if he loses in that one.
You never know what's going to happen, I'll tell you. Well, anyway, everybody, I hope everybody out there tunes in to a great series of programs this year. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing But True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You could go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name, Chepesiuk. You can also join on Facebook and Twitter. He's also a two-time Fulbright Scholar recipient, representing the United States and Bangladesh and Indonesia, I should say. Good for you, Ronnie.
Thank you.
Now, take it away, Ron.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year he'll be publishing a book, which has just been published, by the way, Movers and Mavericks. It's an anthology of influential people from Thunder Bay area. And early next year he'll have another book about the famous Ganalda shipwreck on Lake Superior that happened about 100 years ago. Willie.
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie boy. You know, our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hotcakes. And thanks to Jenny Bogdella of Simpson's Meat and Deli on Simpson Street here in Thunder Bay, Canada. You know, Simpson's Meat and Deli has been kind enough to stock our books at their deli. If you're ever in the area, make sure to check out their delicious selection of smoked meats they make right on site, and it's all MSG and gluten-free. Now, our very, very special guest tonight is Craig Kading, author of Murder Rap, the untold story of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur's murder investigations, two of the most notorious unsolved cases in the annals of American crime. The murders of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls have been the subject of exhaustive investigations, relentless speculations, and a tangled web of rampant rumors, crackpot conspiracies, and dark secrets. Both incidents followed major public events and took place on crowded streets. Shakur was killed in Las Vegas. Notorious Biggie was gunned down in Los Angeles. Both instances, witnesses refused to come forward and help the police. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the holidays, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there for tuning in to Crime Beat last year. Our second year promises to be a more exciting show, Ronnie, and we're looking forward to bringing you more fascinating and intriguing guests. You know, Ronnie, the last half of the year we were cracking 100,000 listeners every week, and we hope to break the 2,000 listener mark and more in 2012. That's going to be our New Year's resolution, buddy.
Okay, I hope we do it.
I'm telling you. Well, anyway, there's no turning back the clock now, and everybody's giving us a thumbs up for the program. I'd also like to thank our production people at Artist First World Radio, in particular Scott, Corey, and Tony, for making the show possible. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, here is this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Eva from Tel Aviv, Israel. Eva writes, I listened to your archive broadcast with John Douglas, who wrote that great book about JFK and the unspeakable, why he died and why it matters. It was a great show. It's not unlike the Yitzhak Rabin assassination conspiracy theory that arose almost immediately following his assassination 16 years ago. Even though a Jewish Israeli student was apprehended within seconds by people in the crowd, and he confessed to the murder, inconsistencies in the inquiry testimony and in the medical records point to conspiracy. You guys should do a show on that subject. Any, Ronnie, any comments, Ronnie?
Yeah, I guess the Rabin assassination is a household topic of conversation in the U.S. For people that don't know anything about it, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995 by a right-wing radical who opposed his signing of the Oslo Accords. It's a conspiracy theory, and every time somebody famous gets killed, you're going to have people coming out of the woodwork claiming something was wrong. I mean, even if Oswald wasn't killed by Ruby, we would still have, controversy. If he went to trial and was convicted and everything, there would still be controversy surrounding that. And I don't have much respect for conspiracy theories after researching Sergeant Smack. In that book I debunked the famous cadaver heroin conspiracy theory that's supposed to have originated in Vietnam, and there's absolutely no grain of truth to that. But we'll do a legitimate ones where there are legitimate questions, like the John F. Kennedy assassination. We had that great show with Douglas, as the as you referred to, and next year we'll have another guest on about that seminal event in American history.
Well, we thank Eva for her letter, and we wish her all the best, and hope she continues to listen to our program. Now, this one is from Lawrence of Oklahoma. He writes, wow, Wahida Clark is some kind of sexy writer. I've read her last three books. Talk about heat. She sounds kind of sexy on the radio, too. Hey, Ronnie, what do you think about that?
Well, it shows our show is encouraging reading, right? Well, Wahida was a great guest. She went to prison, money laundering, and she got in some trouble, and she turned her life around. And that was hip-hop lit is a big trend in literature, and she's got her own publishing company, so our hat's off to her on that. But I'm wondering, has anybody written in and said we're sexy?
Well, time will tell, Ronnie. Come on, let's go. We've got another full 12 months to see if that happens.
Get your mother to write in.
Yeah, or my ex-girlfriend.
Oh, you're right. Oh, well, yeah. I know who she is.
Well,
okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, Ronnie boy, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide, wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show and tell us what you've been up to in your neck of the woods.
Right. Next week we continue with another great program. We have Adrian Humphreys, author of The Weasel, A Double Life in the Mob. It's the story of Marvin Alkind, who also will be on the show. Marvin was a driver for Jimmy Hoffa, and he has a lot of fascinating stories about the mob. In fact, he has a new theory or explanation of what happened to Hoffa. And he has the city in a place that a lot of people would find astonishing, where Hoffa's body ended up after the mafia got through with him. So we're really looking forward to that show. And this month we have two books coming out with Strategic Media Books. We have a book called Scapegoat, and it's a book about a guy named Kenneth Cooper, who's on death row in California. And essentially it's about the framing of Kenneth Cooper. And it's written by Pat O'Connor, and it's a great book. He takes the investigation and shows how shoddy it was. And he's scheduled to die this year on death row, so it's a book that we hope will have an impact. And I'll be coming out with a book called Queenpins, where I profile about 15 notorious woman gangsters in the modern era.
Willie? Well, I'm going to look forward to that. Sounds great. Tell you, Ronnie. Best of luck. Now, as you know, Ron, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, January 6th, San Diego, California. Mexican drug kingpin Benjamin Arellano Felix pleads guilty to U.S. For charges of drug carrying. Mexican drug kingpin Benjamin Arellano pleaded guilty Wednesday to racketeering and conspiracy to laundering money, avoiding the spectacle of a trial for the leader of a cartel that once smuggled hundreds of tons of cocaine and marijuana into the United States and dissolved bodies of its rivals in fats of lye. Hey, Ronnie, any comments on this?
Yeah, I wonder why the press even recovered this story. The key word in that report is once smuggled. This guy is history as far as the Mexican drug trade is concerned. The Arellano Felix family, who I've been tracking, you know, I've written five books on the drug trade back to the 90s, was once one of the most powerful cartels in Mexico, but has since been eclipsed by several other groups. And so he's going away for 25 years. Which is kind of, it seems like a small amount of time, but he's 58 years old, and once he gets out, he's going to have to serve 9 years in Mexico as well. And yeah. Evidently, the case was based on informants, and the prosecutor said that they thought it would be a lengthy case because this Arellano Felix family has a lot of money, and over time informants the testimony of informants erodes. So they were kind of nervous about getting this guy. So I guess that's why they decided to work out a plea agreement with him.
Yeah, it seems like it's cash for a later sentence.
Right.
He's going to have to forfeit $100 million.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, January 5th, 2012, Oklahoma City. 18-year-old Oklahoma mother shoots intruder dead after calling 911. Hey, Ronnie, a young widow who lost her husband to lung cancer on Christmas Day, of all days, protected herself and her baby from a home invasion by shooting one of the intruders dead after asking for permission from a 911 operator. The emergency dispatcher told Sarah McKinley to do what you have to do to protect your baby. Hey, Ronnie, any comments on this extraordinary story?
Yeah, this is quite an extraordinary story, and it raises the question, can you legally kill someone who breaks into your house? And the answer, according to legal experts, it depends on the state, so you have to read your state laws. Here in South Carolina, it can be done, but if you go to San Francisco or someplace in California, you can get in some trouble. But it's really amazing. All the experts say, try to call 911 or get the police on the line. If you can, because that'll protect you. And some legal experts say you better kill the person because they could come back and sue you for everything you have, and that's happened in the past. So it's quite an interesting story. Do you know why this guy was breaking in into their house?
Well,
I never really understood why. I mean, he was after the wife and the baby.
Apparently he was stalking McKinley. He knew McKinley's husband, and apparently it was a drug-related thing. He knew that her husband was dying of cancer, and he had some drugs, and apparently that's the reason they tried to break in. It's a drug related.
Right, she's one brave
situation.
Woman. One brave woman.
Absolutely.
But like I said,
yeah,
read your state laws. It happened in. It could be done in Oklahoma, but maybe not in your state.
Yeah. Well, it's a very fascinating story, and good for her. Anyway, before we get on to our very special guest, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guests, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's featured and special guest is author and ex-LA police detective, Mr. Craig Kading, author of Murder Rap, The Untold Story of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur. With the violent deaths of Tupac Shakur in September of 1996 and Biggie Smalls in March of 1997 came the dramatic end of two hip-hop giants. The circumstances of these two deaths were remarkably similar. Both young men were shot multiple times while sitting in front of passenger seats of their vehicles. Both victims were rushed to hospital by their own entourages. Biggie Smalls was dead on arrival. Tupac Shakur lived for 6 days and endured multiple operations before succumbing to his wounds. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Craig Gating.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Great. Man, you're one internet phenomena, aren't you? You're all over the place, and your book has gotten at least a lot of publicity. How is it doing sales-wise?
Yeah, you know, all things considered, it's doing well. It's self-published, and as you might know, a self-published book doesn't get the kind of distribution and public publicity that a traditionally published book does. So it's doing relatively well. I'm happy with it.
Right. You mentioned the book self-published, and we're dealing with two of the most sensational murder cases in recent memory. You would think that the publishing world would jump at this book, but obviously they never did. You had to self-publish it. Why was that?
Well, it's actually not entirely the truth. What happened was the very first publisher we went to, which was one of the two majors in New York, bought the book right in 2010 for a considerable amount of money. And we went through the whole editorial process, provided the manuscript, everything looked good, and they were really happy with it until it got to their legal department. Once their lawyers got a hold of it, they thought it was just too risky to publish. And their explanation was that they thought it put people in reckless endangerment.
Reckless endangerment. Does that mean that your life might have been, or their lives might have been in danger? Is that what they were worried about?
They were concerned that the exposing the murder suspects, ironically, was the concern. That putting the information out there about who actually pulled the triggers and who was behind the conspiracies, it was endangering their lives.
Right.
And so that was their concern. And so after 9 months of having it at the publishers, they decided to not publish, and I just got the book right back.
Right. Well, you accused some very powerful people. Has there been any efforts to silence you? Like, for example, I know that Puffy Combs is very litigious, and he's been known to throw a few lawsuits around, and his worth is reported to be over $500 million. Did he try to put any pressure on you to silence you or threaten you?
No, not at all. Haven't heard anything from him other than he denies, what we claim in the book. But nothing at all as far as lawsuits or threats, anything of that nature, nothing.
Right. Well, maybe you can summarize what the thesis of your book is.
The thesis of the book is that the murders of Biggie Smalls and the murders of Tupac Shakur were essentially carried out by the heads of their rap labels. Puffy Combs out of Bad Boys New York, and then Suge Knight out of Death Row here in L.A. Basically, it was a brewing animosity between those two individuals and their labels, and it culminated in the murders of Tupac and Biggie.
Right. Well, that's a clear explanation, and you explain it well, and it seems so clear. The question is, why has it taken 16 years for a book like yours to come out, and there's really been no arrests, nothing, no progress on the case, or at least the public can see that.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. The cases got very convoluted. With the case in Los Angeles, an investigator prior to me having the case promoted a theory that took the whole thing down a kind of a rabbit hole. And it captivated the public. Circumstantially, it looked like a viable and plausible explanation for the murders. But in the end, it really came down to the simple explanation of tit for tat, the murder of Biggie in Los Angeles, simply the retaliation of the murder of Tupac in Las Vegas six months earlier.
Are you referring to Russell Poole?
Yes, I am.
Right, Russell Poole, who essentially focused on Suge Knight, right, and his connection to the L.A. Police Department and the gangs.
Yeah, and he was at, and he had been right. I mean, we know now in hindsight that it was Suge Knight that was behind the conspiracy to murder Biggie, but it wasn't the LAPD or the rogue LAPD officers that were involved. It was one of Suge's gang associates.
Right. When you speak of rogue officers, one of the most prominent one was David Mack, right? And he's, you know, supposedly, according to Detective Poole, played a central role in the Smalls murder. But essentially debunk that theory, right?
Yeah, we do debunk that, and quite effectively. I got to tell you that Russ looked at some circumstantial stuff that appeared to be cohesive, but in the end, he was taking the things that supported the theory and applying those, but mm-hmm. seemed to be ignoring the things that refuted the theory. For instance, the Amir Mohammed clue that came in early. If you look at all the elements in that clue, it absolutely disqualifies the Amir Mohammed that he identifies, a guy named Harry Billups.
Right.
You know, everything that's in that clue tells you that it couldn't be Harry Billups.
Right. Right. For the audience that's not familiar with the case, Mohammed was Poole's key suspect as the trigger man who killed Smalls, right?
Correct. And there was never even a Mohammed name attached to that clue. It was just simply the first name of Amir.
Right.
And that's how vague the clue actually was.
Well, you left in 2010, right? And under not really good circumstances. You retired. There was a cloud and all that. Can you explain the circumstances to why you left the LAPD?
Yeah, there were several factors, but primarily, I knew that the police department was shelving the Smalls case. There was not going to be any more proactive effort to bring that to justice. That didn't sit right with me. Two is that I had the book offer
mm-hmm.
and thought that, well, here I can kill two birds with one stone. I can get the public educated as to what the police department knows regarding these murders. Felt that if they're not going to proactively investigate them, we owe it to the public and especially to the families to let them know what we've discovered. And then, of course, I had a major book publisher offering me a
right.
full amount of money to write the book. So it just, everything kind of fell into place to pave the road for me to retire. And I'm glad I did it.
Right. On that, are you working or is this book your sole means of income?
Oh, no, I'm actually not taking any profits from the book. That was one of the things that I know it sounds a little contradictory since I mentioned the Random House or the the publishing house deal, but I decided afterwards, you know, I have a pension, I live comfortably, I didn't want people to think that I was taking advantage of the situation for financial for financial gain. So I decided that any profits from the book would go to charity, and that's the route we're taking.
Right. Right. Well, we're going to talk about, the evidence that you have in your book, but I wanted to cover a few things. First, you state that one of your goals is to vindicate people who were falsely accused of involvement in the murders. Who are these people, and how did you vindicate them?
Well, for instance, it's widely believed by the public worldwide, really, that David Mack and Rafael Perez and a friend of David Mack's, Harry Billups, a.k.a. Amir Mohammed, were the perpetrators of the Biggie Smalls murder. Mm-hmm. And they've been living under that cloud of suspicion for, the past 15 years. So although David Mack is a bank robber and Rafael Perez is committed crimes as a police officer, nonetheless, they were not, as we know now, involved in this murder. And especially Harry Billups, he's kind of an innocent bystander on all of this. And he's been maligned, as has the a guy named Reggie Wright Jr., who is the head of Suge Knight's security force.
Mm-hmm.
He has also been publicly accused of being involved in a conspiracy to commit Tupac, and we know that's not true. So there's quite a few people that deserve to be vindicated, I should say.
Right. Well, you can understand why people would be suspicious of the LAPD, right, given its history. I mean, going way back, it's had a history of corruption. I remember, you know, the Rodney King incident back in the early 90s. So it's understandable that people would be very suspicious if, you know, police were sort of, you know, dismissed as suspects in these investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand that completely, but it doesn't absolve me of the responsibility of knowing what we know now regarding this particular case. Really, we've had our problems in the past, the LAPD, and you know, we should be held accountable for those. But this is a huge issue right here for having to believe that we're involved in the murder of such a prominent rap star. It's a, you know, and we know now that it isn't the case, and the LAPD should be vindicated of that public perception.
Right. Well, how do you explain that, you know, nothing's happened in 16 years, really? I mean, at least the public's perception is that nothing's happened with the murder investigations. There's been no arrests, you know, nothing that sort of leads to progress.
I got to tell you, it's really disappointing. In 2009, when I was taken off the case, the whole thing just kind of plateaued. There was no meaningful follow-up after that. And, of course, after Zaletta Wallace dropped her lawsuit against the city, that really was the last gasp of hope to get these things solved. The LAPD was now out from under that threat of a multi-million-dollar, you know, judgment.
Right.
And they decided that it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. They shelved the case, put everybody back to their prior assignments, and nothing else was done that led to solving the case.
Right. Well, you know, some listeners may think you're an apologist for LAPD, but you actually say some harsh things about the police, and I was going to read something from your book. You said it's my belief that the LAPD carefully weighed its options and decided that all things considered, it's best suited to let sleeping dogs lie. What were the sleeping dogs that they wanted to let lie?
Well, bringing up the whole Biggie Smalls murder case in a criminal proceeding, obviously the best defense is going to be, hey, this is just really the LAPD trying to pin the murder on somebody else when in fact they themselves were the perpetrators. It was going to be a very complicated and convoluted prosecution should it have been filed.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that. It was going to raise all of these issues. So here we were 13 years after the fact, and they were out from under the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. I think they just made the political decision that they would just let it remain on the shelves as it had prior to 2006 when I joined the reinvigorated investigation. So, you know, I'm trying to exonerate them from the public perception that we were involved, but I also am pointing a finger saying that we are absolutely negligent in the handling of the case.
Right.
And bear the responsibility for it not being solved.
I solicited comments from some people that are more familiar with hip-hop culture than Willie or I are. Well, one of them is my friend Scott Wilson, who writes a hip-hop column for Planet Ill. And this is what he said, and I want you to comment. He said, I heard it said that the murders of Pac and Biggie Smalls will never get solved simply because the powers that be do not care. There's no grand conspiracy or cover-up because neither Pac or Biggie were important enough to merit one. That their deaths are only important to the black community. Is there any truth to such notions? And Scott's African-American, and I'm sure he expresses the opinion of a lot of African-Americans, especially those that are listening to the show.
I would say this. Neither of these cases got the effort that they deserve. You know, certainly, I think if these had been other people, maybe, you know, prominent white figures, maybe it would have been different. I can't really say, but I certainly feel that we were completely negligent in the handling of the case.
Right. Well, you know, that's what I was thinking when I was reading your book. I was saying, you know, Bruce Springsteen got killed in Las Vegas, and Tom Petty got killed in L.A. I mean, you know, these cases would have been solved 16 years ago.
Well, yeah, but in response to that, had Tom Petty or Bruce Springsteen been killed, the individuals around them would have been rushing to help. And they would have been providing law enforcement with the, you know, with the information that probably could have solved those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind the type of people, the characters that law enforcement was having to deal with in regard to the Biggie and Tupac case. Nobody wanted to cooperate with the police department to any effective degree. Mm-hmm. Most were going out of their way not to cooperate.
Right.
So it's not really a, I just don't think it's a fair comparison. You've got to, you know, and I don't, and I'm not trying to argue the fact that maybe the fact that you guys were African Americans had something to do with it, but I would argue the fact that there was a responsibility from that community, especially those people that surround that individual, to be more proactive in helping to solve the case.
Right. I actually agree with you. You know, there's a very strong Stop Snitching campaign, and there's a real hesitancy of, you know, cooperating with police. So I can see how that could hinder your investigation. Willie, let's take a break, and we'll get back with our fascinating guest, Greg Kading. Go ahead, Willie. Hello?
You looking for Willie?
This is weird. Yeah, well, this is Crime Beat Radio Show. And we're on the air with Craig Kading. He's the author of Murder Rap, The Untold Story of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur, Murder Investigations. And the book is self-published, but it's doing very well. And where can listeners get a copy of your book?
Available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And I have a website, MurderRap.com. It links to both of those online bookstores, but it's available online.
Right. And there's an interesting website, which you don't run, but, you know, is connected to your investigation, I believe, in some ways. Truthabouttupac.com?
Yeah, truthabouttupac.com is a website run by a guy named Asher Underwood. He's very, very passionate about the legacy of Tupac Shakur and is very interested in seeing justice brought to the murder of Tupac Shakur. So it's a great website for Tupac fans.
Right. So we were talking about the investigation and L.A. and some of the problems with it, but fortunately you were able to leave your job with a whole bunch of documents, right?
I took copies of just about everything that I participated in, and there's been some question whether that was ethically appropriate or not. I defend it by saying that when push comes to shove, I've got to defend myself. And, you know, I've been through enough civil and criminal trials where I have to have the documentation to support the claims that I make. And I can't rely on the LAPD or anybody else's tracking system to have that documentation. You know, the LAPD has a somewhat, you know, questionable history of
right
maintaining documents and tracking of evidence.
Well, I know that I know from my own experience, cause I've done a lot of investigations, that a lot of DEA agents, for example, take records home with them, and it's quite helpful to authors like myself, because there's always, you know, a wall of silence put up by officialdom on that. So I think that, you know, a lot of people are happy that you managed to leave. Did they put any pressure on you to return the documents or to stay silent?
No, not at all. I think the LAPD may have been a little bit surprised by my coming out with the book, but I haven't heard from them. As a matter of fact, I think the opposite is true. They're telling people within the department not to really have any contact or follow up with me. So I think that they've just accepted the fact that this has all happened, and you know, it's going to take its course.
Right. What type of documents did you leave it? What kind of evidence? Because this, you know, this forms the backbone of your book, and your confidence in that you have a pretty good case for solving the two murders.
Type of stuff that I was personally involved in. You know, if I conducted an interview, I would keep a copy of my own interview tape. If I wrote a report, I'd keep a copy of my own report. If I wrote a search warrant, I'd keep a copy of my search warrant. And of course, I kept extremely exhaustive notes of everything I did. So those were the primary material that I relied on to write the book.
Right. I'm kind of surprised that Detective Poole didn't write a book. you know, given his vocal nature and, you know, his criticism of the LAPD. Have you talked with him, or have you heard any comments about him about your book?
No, I haven't. I think that if he had wrote a book, it would look exactly like Labyrinth, which was the book written by
Sullivan.
Randall Sullivan. I think the majority of the material that book was gleaned from was provided by Poole. As a matter of fact, if you go to the back of that book, there's a bibliography, and you know, everything in there is from law enforcement records that clearly had to come from Poole. At least that was my impression. So I think if he had written a book, it would have been Labyrinth, you know, again, or Labyrinth 2.
Right. Well, let's take the Shakur murder first. What evidence do you have? I read the book, so I know that, but to the audience, explain your evidence that leads you to the conclusion that the people that were responsible for the murder.
Combination of many factors. Obviously, the strongest evidence is the testimony of Keefe D, in which he claimed him, his nephew, and a couple other Crip associates carried out the murder. However, he does claim that the murder was solicited by Bobby Cohn sometime before the murder actually took place. So we have his testimonial evidence, and then within that testimonial evidence, he provides a bunch of material that was unknown to the public. It's consistent to what we knew in the investigation. So he was corroborating his own statement with material that we had. And then the outside sources were all of the stories that were building up to that event. You know, one of the strongest things, I don't know if you're aware of this, that in December of 1995, an individual named Mark Anthony Bell was an associate of Puffy Combs, was accosted at a Christmas party. He was taken upstairs at a house by Tupac Shakur, Suge Knight, and several other of Suge Knight's blood associates. And they literally beat the hell out of this guy in an attempt to find out where Puffy Combs was. They wanted to know where his family was. They wanted to know where he was. Mm-hmm. This individual the next day went to the police department, made a police report, told the whole story about how desperately Suge was trying to find Puffy. And obviously that word got back to Puffy that out here on the West Coast, Suge was hunting him down. And essentially, we had to do preemptive strike. He surrounded himself with these Crips, who were the natural enemy of Suge's henchmen. And when he'd come out to the West Coast for his concert tours, he'd have these Crips around to kind of insulate him, Suge. And it was a game of cat and mouse, and people were starting to die. Suge's bodyguard had been killed in Atlanta by one of the guys from Combs' crew a year before. So this rivalry was very, very real, very deadly, and it was just a matter of time till either Suge or Puffy, you know, fell themselves.
Right. Well, you also say that he was offered, Keffy was offered $1 million.
Hey, Ron?
Yes.
I just got an email from Willie. He got disconnected. We're going to go ahead and go to a break and call Willie real quick.
Okay, that sounds good then. Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back.
Sorry, Greg. We're just warming up here. This is the first time this happened. In a whole year of programming.
Nope.
now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Oh, sorry for that pause there. We had a technical difficulty, but we're back on the air with Greg Kading talking about the murder investigations of Biggie Smalls and Shoe Left to Care. So we were talking about the $1 million that was offered to kill Tupac, right? And this is what Kefi Davis told you?
Yeah, and it was actually a solicitation to kill Suge and Tupac. It was primarily Suge who they were after. That was the real issue that Puffy was having, according to QPD. And then Tupac was kind of added to the program after the after this Mark Bell got accosted, and after he was publicly calling the East Coast guys out. So Tupac kind of put himself on that list a little bit.
Right.
It was about Suge.
Right. And what's happened to Davis?
Absolutely nothing. He's just living the life of Keith Davis. Nothing was done to further any of the drug charges that we had established during the investigation.
Why not?
That's a great question. The whole thing just got shelved. I mean, we had set up a tremendous opportunity to clear all kinds of things. We had leverage on everybody.
Right.
And a lot of people were looking at a lot of time, and not a single indictment came down. The whole thing just got shelved.
Right. Well, you must have some thoughts on what you think happened. What do you think happened? Was there corruption involved, or what? They didn't really have a case, or how do you explain this? Because this is quite amazing.
You know what? It was just, I think, a series of unfortunate events. The U.S. attorney that was overseeing the Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur investigation,
right.
Was also the U.S. attorney that had just previously handled the George Torres case. And, he got some bad press, and basically that investigation and the trial of that case, it put him in a difficult position at work, I think. And I think he just kind of hung his hat up for the moment. That's all I can say about that. I don't really have much of an explanation why
right.
cases were just dropped.
Right. But he'll never...
I got a quick question. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a quick question for you, Greg. A lot of people are saying hip-hop is dead. In the 80s, 90s, it was really exciting to listen to. It was groundbreaking music, and now it's reduced to a one-note type of din. So what happened? Any opinion on that?
No, I don't know. I think that, music evolves. I think that the gangster rap style of music, it was just, I think people got to the point where they're just tired of it. I mean, it sounded at first, it was interesting. It was a reflection of what was going on in the streets. But there was so much criminal activity around it that the public were just thought, this is nonsense. It's just crazy. I mean, why are we supporting something that leads to people being shot and celebrate all of these this horrible lifestyle?
Right. Willie, let's take a break, and we'll go into our last part. We'll get to we're talking about Teresa Swan when we get back. Go ahead, Willie.
You bet. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and Will Rib. Now back to our very fascinating guest and Ron. Go ahead, Ronnie.
Right. We're back with Greg Kading and the author of Murder Rap, The Untold Story of the Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur, Murder Investigations. And Greg Kading says that he has solved the cases, and we're talking about the evidence. The book is self-published, but it's available everywhere because it's really a hot book. There's a lot of discussion going on about it, on that. Greg, this is a really well-written book. I was really surprised. Did you do it yourself?
No, I've got to give credit to a guy that helped me out on it. He decided he didn't want his name attached to it. fantastic guy and a great writer. And he helps me out with it. I had no experience writing books. I'm a decent writer, but it probably would have sounded more like a police procedural had I done it alone.
Right. Well, I thought you were the second coming of Ernest Hemingway. on that. Well, let's talk about Teresa Swan and the murder of Biggie Smalls. Teresa Swan is prominent in your book. It's a pseudonym, right, for a woman that was associated with Suge Knight. And tell us about what evidence do you have that connects Suge Knight to the murder of Biggie Smalls.
A very compelling confession and testimony of Teresa Swan, which, as you mentioned, is an alias.
Right.
We put her into a position where she had to make the difficult choice of either go to jail and potentially losing her kids or come clean with what she knew. And so she gave this very emotional and sincere confession about her meetings with Suge after Tupac was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Suge was imprisoned, or I should say incarcerated, as a result of a probation violation stemming from the beating out there in Las Vegas prior to the murder. So he was incarcerated. He was enraged at what had happened to Tupac. And he had Teresa Swan, who he was able to get into a position to have confidential conversations with her. And he tells her to get a hold of one of his henchman, one of his known shooters,
mm-hmm.
named Wardell South,
mm-hmm.
and she does it and tells us all the details, how she met with him in jail,
mm-hmm.
How the money was paid, and gave a bunch of descriptors and information that was consistent with what we knew, and that led to us identifying this guy named Pucci as the shooter.
Right, right. Well, where is she now? And is she in protective custody, or you know, what happened to her?
Yeah, I can't say. I can't really respond. I can't respond to that. She's living her life.
Right.
She's just hoping. She's kind of putting her head in the sand and hoping this whole thing just goes away.
right.
I don't want anything to happen to her. I appreciate what she did, but at the same time, you know, it wasn't like she came to us out of remorse or out of regret. You know, her and Keefe D.
Right. What was her motivation for blowing the whistle on Suge Knight?
Staying out of jail and not losing custody of your kids.
Right. Now, I know you're not a lawyer, but with this type of testimony, both with Keefe and Teresa Swan, stand up in court by itself, or do you have to have other piece of evidence to bring a murder charge?
Well, both of their testimonies would stand up in court. They would both be admissible testimonies, and they would both be required to testify. Those were the agreements that we made. You know, unfortunately, neither of them was before the grand jury, which is something that should have been done. But in the event that there is a case made, that they would both be required to testify, and that was one of the conditions of our agreement.
Right. So the LAPD is sitting on this evidence, right? They have this evidence. And do you think that they're going to act on it? I know that I read a report in a couple weeks ago that they reopened the investigation. Or they say they have.
Yeah, that's just lip service. There's no investigation going on. I can actually guarantee that. I can assure you there is no proactive investigation going on whatsoever. The two investigators that were assigned to that case, they're called the custodians of the case.
Right.
Not working it. They are both assigned to other murder investigations, and nothing's being done on this.
Right. Well, you can understand why there's conspiracy theories, right? There's a lot of conspiracy theories. One of them is that, you know, both Biggie and Tupac were more valuable dead, right? So there was a conspiracy to kill them. What do you think about these conspiracy theories? What's the most crackpot theory that you've heard out there?
Well, the most crackpot theory that I've heard, obviously, is that Tupac's still alive and, you know, worked for the U.S. government or something to that effect.
Or with Elvis.
Yeah, or the Illuminati got him, or something like that. Those are, you know, those real fringe theories. That, you know, obviously, a guy wrote a book made a documentary about the theory of Suge Knight having Tupac killed in Vegas because Tupac was allegedly going to leave the label. And
right.
But it's all just very loose circumstantial material that it's drawn from, and it really doesn't hold any water in a legitimate investigation.
Right. But, you know, they're bigger now than they were probably during their life, right? I mean, their record sales are going through the roof. Tupac's, icon, and Biggie Smalls big. So there's some truth to that. I mean, you know, they are bigger now probably than when they were alive.
Well, it is hard to say, but maybe so. It's hard to say. We don't know where they would be if they were still alive. I mean, look what Puffy's gone on to do.
Right.
And Suge Knight, although Tupac's worth more now, I mean, look at Suge Knight. He doesn't have a pot to piss in. So, you know, that theory that he had Tupac killed in order to gain his royalties, that certainly didn't work out.
Right. Right. But the police investigated that, right? They didn't just dismiss it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We investigated everything. We looked at every angle. As a matter of fact, what led us to solving Tupac's murder was that we were looking at the Southside Crips, Keefe D and his crew, as being involved in the Biggie murder. So we were taking everything. We were looking at the David Mack and Raphael conspiracy case. We were looking at every possible, none of them had any evidence outside of just circumstance and speculation.
Right.
Well, hey, Craig, how many police officers were on the case on both these murders? Can you tell us that?
Well, when I was with the task force from 2006 to 2009, there was about 12 of us assigned specifically to that case, and that was a multi-agency investigation, FBI, DEA, ATF, and LAPD, and the LA County Sheriff. So there were a number of us working in cooperation with each other on the Biggie case. And then once we stumbled upon the Tupac case with TFD, we were all, you know, combining our concerted efforts for that. So quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the suspicion that Biggie knew something about the conspiracy to murder Tupac? What's your conclusion on that?
Yeah, that's a really unfortunate that carried any weight at all. There's no evidence whatsoever that Biggie was aware what happened, that mm-hmm. there was a conspiracy to kill Tupac. There's just nothing. We don't have a single statement in that regard. There was some rather reckless reporting by the LA Times mm-hmm. that Biggie was behind the murder of Tupac. It's not only refuted, but has been recanted. So poor Valletta Wallace had to live with a false rumor for a while. But there's no truth. There's no reason to believe that to be true whatsoever.
Right. Valletta Wallace is the mother of Biggie Smalls. And one of the most interesting, angles. We're running out of time here, so we're going to have to. We could go on for another hour on this fascinating topic. Is the gang connection? You know, the Bloods and the Crips. You know, Crips with Puffy Combs and Bloods with Knight. What connection do gangs have to the murders?
Well, in regard to the Suge camp, very deep. Suge had these guys from Compton called the Mob Piru.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them were doing bodyguard and security work for Death Row. They were always in the studios, always going around whatever events were going around with Death Row. So the Mob Piru connection with Suge Knight was very deep and very real. Mm-hmm. Regarding the Southside Crips and Puffy Combs, a little different. That came about by way of a drug associate of Puffy Combs, his name, Eric Martin. His name was
Dick.
He was a PCP dealer who had been doing a lot of drug activities PPD for years, and that's how PPD and his group got connected with Puffy. And then when Puffy started having problems with Suge, and PPD and his crew offered protection, and everything just fell into place for Puffy to be using these Crips as quasi-security during his West Coast days.
Right. Well, we're finishing up, and got about 30 seconds. This is my final question. Will we ever have closure to the killings of Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls? Will there ever be closure to this case? Will there ever be people going to jail and people finally saying, yeah, this is the way it was?
I think so. I think I'm quite confident that Valletta Wallace knows that the story I'm telling to be the true story.
Mm-hmm.
And so she knows that the actual killer of her son also died you know, the same type of death that her son was subjected to. So Poochie is dead. Tupac's killer Orlando Anderson is dead. So there has been some, you know, divine intervention or some divine justice in regard to the actual killers. But as far as the conspirators, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think that law enforcement is going to recover. We lost our momentum. We lost our initiative. I don't think we're going to be able to recover and prosecute anybody at this point, unfortunately.
I should have one other question. Do you carry a gun and look over your shoulder?
No, I don't live like that at all. I don't live in fear. I just tell the truth as I know it and let the chips fall where they may. I wasn't going to put myself into a position where I was going to have to worry about that stuff.
Well, we wish you good luck, Greg. And this has been a great interview. And we hope to have you back. We've been inviting guests, previous guests. We're starting to invite them this year and maybe get you back in nine months or so to find out what's happened with you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And I recommend Greg's book, Murder Rap. It's a great read. Go out and get it. And we just touched the surface of the book, and you'll find a lot of fascinating information. Willie?
Well, that's great, Ronnie. Thanks for that, and thanks again to our very, very special guest, Mr. Greg Kading. Very fascinating interview. We're privileged to have him on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the broadcast tonight?
Well, I learned a lot more than before the program started, but I'm just amazed he had these two talents, really talented artists, and they were forced to die young because of some stupid feud. And my hat goes off to Craig Kading for having the courage to try to revive this investigation. And, of course, there's always going to be a cloud around the LAPD until they clean up their act. How about you, Willie?
Yeah. Well, you know what, Ronnie? I think these two guys just got too big for their own good, sorry to say. Most of the rap stuff they wrote was about extreme violence. And live by the sword, die by the sword. That's like a glove, buddy. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat Joke of the Month segment. Well, here we go. A hooded bank robber burst into a Texas bank and forced the tellers to load a sack full of cash. On his way out the door, a brave Texas customer grabbed the hood and pulled it off, revealing the crook's face. Without hesitating, the robber shot the customer dead in his tracks. The crook then looked around the bank and noticed one of the tellers looking straight at him. The robber instantly shot him as well. Everyone else by now was petrified, looking intently down at the floor in silence. The robber then yelled, "Well, did anyone else see my face?" There were a few moments of utter silence where everyone was plainly afraid to speak. Then one old man tentatively raised his hand and said, "My wife got a pretty good look at you."
You finally, after almost a year, you got a good one on
that was
there. But I'll tell you what, I know there are a lot of guys who have wives that wish you're in a bank that's getting robbed, right?
Well, I'll tell you. Well, we'll come up with something better the next time.
Okay.
Just a reminder for all of you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for January the 19th, where we'll have our very special guest, author Adrian Humphreys, who wrote the fascinating and best-selling book titled The Weasel, A Double Life in the Mob. Along with Humphreys will be Marvin Elkind, the subject of the narrative who learned that he was better as a career informant than a crook. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and yours truly. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening and hope you'll be with us for our second year of Crime Beat. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Shepsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Good night, Willie.